change. It can happen more quickly. It's more deadly. And these emergency managers, people in positions of responsibility, need to be on the ground, need to be at the ready, not posing for their photographs in their on their LinkedIn pages and Instagram pages. They need to be caring about and compassionate for the people who are in harm's way.
Monica Medina, finally, this issue of the climate catastrophe, the same day of the floods, you have President Trump signing off on the budget that eviscerates support for renewable energy and supercharges a fossil fuel economy. As people point the finger at who's responsible and say, come on, this is, no one could have predicted this. Isn't that at the heart of the climate change? Unpredictability, but more severe and more frequent climate catastrophes like this one.
It's at the very heart of what we're seeing today and why it's even more tragic that this legislation is happening and going into effect. It was ludicrous that the Speaker of the House said, all we can do is pray. That is not true. We have the capacity. We are not powerless. What we are doing is making ourselves powerless by taking away the tools, by taking away the high technology and the know-how and the people that can give us the ability to be prepared for storms like this and to save lives. That's what's at risk here.
Finally, the cost of NOAA per person in this country, Monica Medina.
It's trivial. It costs the equivalent for each citizen of a cup of coffee. It's less than $5 a year per citizen to have the kind of warnings and watches that NOAA is responsible for. And if you put in, if you add in the satellites and all the other research that we do to keep improving those forecasts and giving people more time to prepare, that's two cups of coffee in a year to cover the cost of all of that. It's trivial. We can afford it. We are not like other countries who can't afford to put these systems in place. We have built them up with hard work and incredible research over 100 years, and now we're dismantling it in the space of a few short weeks and months. We're firing the people. We're stopping taking in the data. We're ending the research. We're turning off the satellites. We're doing everything we possibly can to put our heads in the sand in the midst of what is increasingly dangerous weather.
Monica Medina, I want to thank you for being with us, former Principal Deputy Administrator of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, during the Obama administration, as well as a former Assistant Secretary of State for Oceans and International Environmental and Scientific Affairs. She also co-hosts the Scientista podcast. Coming up, a federal judge has issued a nationwide injunction against President Trump's executive order ending birthright citizenship. We'll speak with the ACLU's Legal Ernst. Stay with us.
Sad scenes of destruction on every hand. Black waters, black waters rise over
performed by Nora Brown and Stephanie Coleman in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge in New Hampshire has issued a new nationwide injunction against President Trump's executive order ending birthright citizenship. Thursday's ruling came in response to a class action lawsuit filed by the ACLU and other groups on behalf of immigrant parents and infants born since February 20th, when President Trump signed the executive order. The lawsuit was filed just hours after the Supreme Court's ruling last month on birthright citizenship, which curtailed the power of judges to issue nationwide injunctions. Thursday's ruling was issued by Judge Joseph LaPlante, who was appointed to the bench by Republican President George W. Bush. Judge LaPlante said during the hearing, quote, the preliminary injunction is just not a close call to the court. The deprivation of U.S. citizenship and an abrupt change of policy that was longstanding, that's irreparable harm, he said. The ACLU lawsuit argued Trump's order would result in children born to undocumented parents being rendered effectively stateless. To talk more about this case and more, we're joined by Lee Glernt, deputy director of the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project. Lee, thanks so much for being with us. Talk about the significance of this ruling and how you got around the Supreme Court.
Yeah, this is enormously important because if these children lose citizenship, not only is that a precious right, but various benefits, life-saving type benefits, food, medical care, could have been lost to them. So we're extremely pleased that the court has issued this injunction and it's nationwide. So what the Supreme Court said in the birthrights case that went up there, the Casa case, as you mentioned, was that plaintiffs without a class action couldn't necessarily get a nationwide injunction. It didn't rule it out completely, but it put its thumb on the scale against that and said the proper way to do it is to bring a class action and have the district court decide that a class action is proper. And so that's what we did. We brought a class action showing that this kind of relief is nationwide necessary, and the judge agreed. So we feel like this is the way the Supreme Court told us to do it, and that's what we did.
So talk about President Trump's response and what he's saying about the 14th Amendment and the idea that birthright citizenship only applied to the children of slaves.
Yeah, so we obviously think that is patently wrong. The Supreme Court has said it's wrong. There is multiple cases from the Supreme Court dating back more than a century saying that the 14th Amendment applied to undocumented immigrants. And so the lower courts are properly following that. The historical research shows that it wasn't meant just to protect slaves. So we think we're absolutely on the right side of this. I think every president has adhered to what the 14th Amendment says, and what more importantly, the Supreme Court says the 14th Amendment says. So we do not think there's any merit to what the government's arguing, and it's a cruel policy. It's fundamentally altering the nature of how America has viewed people born on this in this country. And so we're hopeful we'll prevail. So far, every court that's looked at this has said that we are right, that the 14th Amendment doesn't just protect us, just protects slaves, it protects undocumented immigrants as well, and provides birthright citizenship to them. So we'll see what the Supreme Court does. Obviously, it'll go back to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court will have to decide whether to overrule their precedents. We hope that they will not.
But explain what it would mean if Trump got his way.
Yeah, that the consequences would be devastating. I mean, even going forward, right? So children born on U.S. soil would no longer be citizens. They could be stateless. They would be denied basic medical care. If you go back through history, you look at how many children this would have affected, and some of the most famous people, the people who contributed to America. I think it's hard to even understand the implications, but what it would mean quickly is you're born on U.S. soil, you used to be a U.S. citizen, that used to be a hallmark of America, and then all of a sudden you wouldn't be a citizen. It's not clear where you'd be a citizen of. The children could be stateless. The consequences would be devastating.
Lee, I want to ask you about another case you're involved in. The government of El Salvador has admitted to UN investigators that the Trump administration controls the fate of nearly 140 Venezuelan immigrants who were transferred from the U.S. to the notorious Secut mega prison. The revelations contradict claims by Trump officials and DOJ lawyers who've repeatedly said they don't have the jurisdiction or power to facilitate the return of the immigrants who were renditioned to El Salvador from the U.S. without due process. In the document, the Salvadoran government states, quote, the jurisdiction and legal responsibility for these persons lie exclusively with the competent foreign authorities. Talk about how you got this document. And does it mean that Justice Department lawyers have repeatedly lied in court?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about that, because I think this is a remarkable turn of events. So just first of all, how we got the UN document. Our friends at Human Rights First a long time ago wrote to the UN on behalf of a few families asking what's happened to their families. The UN sent, as they're supposed to, sent the inquiry to the El Salvador government. El Salvador responded fairly quickly to the UN saying, we are not responsible for these detainees. This is the responsibility of the state that sent us these detainees. And so it was, you know, a sort of explosive document, to say the least, because the United States government had been repeatedly telling courts, we can't do anything about these individuals at CECOT. It's solely El Salvador's responsibility. What's remarkable, and so that finally the document was sent to the families gave it to us. But what's remarkable is that the United States did not give us the document or give the court the document. We specifically asked for all those types of documents in what's called discovery. They admitted that document. Obviously, it was relevant. I mean, more than relevant. It's explosive. So we'll have to see. We've told the court about it now. We're going to have to see what other documents were not turned over to us. But it directly contradicts what the United States has been saying. I mean, as you mentioned, that night of March 15th, they sent more than 100 men, maybe over 200 men, without any due process to this prison. They may languish there for the rest of their lives in one of the most notorious places in the world. The United States is saying, well, okay, maybe there was a due process violation, but what do you want us to do about it? El Salvador controls everything. Now we all of a sudden find this document where El Salvador is saying the opposite. We'll see how the U.S. government tries to whitewash it, but I suspect there are many other documents out there that are relevant, and so we will begin asking for those documents.
So essentially, I mean, what's very clear, right, is that Bukele, who describes himself as the coolest dictator in the world, is getting paid millions of dollars to incarcerate these men. So the U.S. Right. has a direct relationship. If it took away the money, what would happen?
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up, because I just want to make clear that this document doesn't change things in our mind. It simply confirms what we already knew and what I think everyone knows is, of course, the U.S. controls this. As you said, the U.S. is paying for these detainees to be there. El Salvador has no relationship to these Venezuelan men. These are not Salvadoran citizens. They're holding them there as if a private prison, and they're getting paid for it. If the U.S. took the money away or said, we need these detainees back because a federal court has said that due process was violated, of course we could get them back. So we knew that all the time. And I think everyone sort of understands that. The importance of this document is it confirms El Salvador saying it. But you're absolutely right. We are paying as if we were paying a private prison to hold these individuals.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Lee Gelernt, Deputy Director of the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project, to see our interviews about some of these men, like the Venezuelan hairdresser Andri Hernandez Romero, go to democracynow.org. Coming up, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Turk. Nunca más, never again, by La Santa Cecilia in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk. I spoke to him last week when I went to Geneva, Switzerland. We were speaking in the UN Human Rights Council. In part one of our conversation, we talked about Israel's war on Gaza. Now we turn to part two. We talked about immigration policy in the U.S., climate change, and more. I started by asking the UN High Commissioner about the changing role of the U.S. in the world. So, Volker Turk, let's talk about the role of the United States, the most powerful country on Earth. In March, you expressed deep concern about a fundamental shift in direction in the United States under President Trump. Can you elaborate?
Look, I have been very worried about what happens on the deportations and the treatment of migrants, for example. And I've been worried about it because I see also the vilification of migrants and refugees in the public debate. I lived in New York during COVID. I was every day grateful for the migrant workers that kept the city going in terms of making sure that the garbage is collected, that we get our food. I was actually at some stage wondering if they didn't work, what would happen to all of us? We might actually starve. And now I see the vilification of migrant workers. I see a debate that reminds me of times that we thought we had all overcome. And yes, that worries me because it polarizes and divides a society and it pits one group against the other. And that's not what I know the United States to be. The United States, for me, is a country that helped resettle refugees who were extremely vulnerable, who were persecuted. I remember when, in previous times, the highest number of refugees that came from war-torn countries were accepted and hosted in the United States. And I wish that this part of the United States comes out much more strongly in an environment that, frankly, is so divided.
So let's talk about SACOT for a minute. In May, you expressed alarm over the Trump administration's use of a Salvadoran mega prison to detain immigrants without due process, potentially for life. Your office has received information from family members and lawyers regarding more than 100 Venezuelans believed to be held at SACOT. Can you talk about the men who have been shipped to this mega prison?
So we were in touch with family members who didn't know where their loved ones were, which for us, of course, always raises the alarm bells when it comes to, are they missing? Are they disappeared? What happened to them? And it is an obligation of the state when you engage in deportations to inform, you know, to provide information. And frankly, the fact that it went to a third country and not to the country of origin after due process, because due process always has to be guaranteed, is a huge worry and a huge concern. I wrote to the president of El Salvador about the conditions. We don't have access there.
President Bukele, who called himself the coolest dictator in the world.
Well, we wrote to him and we have engaged with the El Salvadorian authorities because, of course, there are human rights concerns that are attached to what's happening. And we have not been able to have access. So
has he responded?
No, he has not. Which happens sometimes, but at the same time, as you know, including in the council that you see behind you, the council is also for us the place where we can put issues and situations into the spotlight of international attention. So for us it's also very important when we don't get the cooperation that we need to actually mention it then in the public arena.
And he hasn't let you into that prison?
We have not had access since that period.
Talking about immigration, what's happening to immigrants in the United States, you urged U.S. authorities earlier this month to respect the right to peaceful assembly and refrain from using military force in the context of the huge protests around Trump's policies. Your reaction to Trump overriding California's governor, deciding to send in the first National Guard, then the Marines to crack down on the protests?
Well, I made it absolutely clear before the council that any militarized response to the freedom of peaceful assembly is absolutely not warranted when indeed you have peaceful assembly. That's a fundamental freedom. So I hope that it will come to a rethink of this type of approaches in the future, because we know what it means when you militarize responses to essentially law enforcement issues. But there is always the fundamental right of freedom of expression, of peaceful assembly, of solidarity with people who are vulnerable. And that needs to be respected.
You once quoted the 20th century philosopher Antonio Gramsci, imprisoned by the Italian fascist Mussolini for 12 years till his death. You were making a comparison between fascism in Europe during early 20th century and the surge of populism and nationalism and xenophobia today. You quoted Gramsci saying, "The old world is dying and the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters." Who are the monsters today?
The monsters today are the lack of solidarity and empathy and compassion that we see, unfortunately, reign not just in North America, but also in Europe, in other parts of the world. I mean, I just came from Sri Lanka, just to give you an example. After 16 years of when the war ended in a brutal way, I still see the ghosts of the past haunting the present. And it's as a result of fundamental divisions and polarizations and prejudice and racism that we saw what happened in the past. And I do think that the monsters of today is the absence of a public space where you can have a proper discussion, where you can agree to disagree, but you actually have a debate about challenges. What I see is people getting warped into their own bubbles, their echo chambers, not listening to the other anymore, and not understanding the grievances that exist and trying to find a solution to it. So for me, it's actually politics that has become quite tone deaf to the real concerns that people have. And that worries me a lot, because the absence of a public space means the absence of compromise, the absence of finding a solution, the absence of debating and disagreeing or agreeing and you know, fighting it out, but in a constructive way that actually leads to solutions.
There's just a piece in the Washington Post about the cutting of USAID funding in the world. And it said, "Children clung to life in Sudan by the slenderest of threads, supported by community soup kitchens. Then the USAID funding cuts came, and their mothers watched them starve to death one by one." Can you talk about the effects of this drastic cut, the ending, essentially, of USAID in the world, programs that had been established for years, and also the cuts to the United Nations and the effects that has had, those cuts by the United States, by President Trump?
So it is extremely, extremely unfortunate that USAID is no longer there in the way that we know it. Because USAID provided immediate relief to millions of people. It made sure that human rights NGOs at the grassroots level, for example, I've met many of them, are running out of funding and may no longer be able to be the fighters for freedom and justice. It means that, as you just mentioned, in many conflict situations around the world, we simply will not be able to provide the humanitarian assistance that is required. And that means, real-life consequences. People will die, people will end up in extremely vulnerable situations, and it will lead to potentially more conflict. I mean, what the U.S. generously has done for decades has been its soft power. It has also influenced things in a positive way. Now that's gone, and yes, I'm worried about it. The same with the United Nations. The fact that some of the massive funding, my own organization, we are not getting, our funding was cut, which means that we will not be able to continue doing the monitoring and the reporting and the documenting and the intervening and being the bridge between civil society and the institutions of the state. For example, in Colombia, we have to cut our operation by half. And that has, again, we have an important part of the peace process. It means that this will suffer. And yes, these are the real-life consequences of such decisions, which I regret very much.
I just watched you give an opening address here at the UN Human Rights Council. You were talking about climate change. We at Democracy Now! Have attended the UN climate summits from Copenhagen in 2009 on to what will be on the edge of the rainforest, the Brazil UN climate summit. We also just came here from New York. We were experiencing a major heat dome in New York. Came to Geneva. You're experiencing here the same thing, extreme weather raging across the globe. The Financial Times reporting Sunday, quote, temperatures reached dangerous highs as heat domes hit Europe and the U.S. Volker Turk, you've called for states, corporations to be held to account, including for damage to our climate and environment. Can you relate the climate catastrophe that we are experiencing to immigration, to the crises that we're experiencing around the world with that, to poverty, to indigenous rights, and who is responsible?
So the climate crisis is absolutely a human rights crisis. There's no doubt about it. And one of the big collateral damages of the wars that we see today is actually that there is less focus on the big challenges of our time, such as climate change. I mean, a couple of years ago, I remember when I came to New York in 2019, there were young people on the streets. Everyone was protesting and you know, activating Fridays for Future. There were all these movements about making sure that climate change and climate action is addressed properly. Today, you don't see it in the same way, and despite the fact that we already live the consequences. I mean, the heat dome over the Europe, I mean, we've decided not to wear ties anymore as a result, but it shows, when it also affects us, what does it mean for indigenous peoples? What does it mean for the most vulnerable? What does it mean for a woman who has 6 children in the Sahel, how she's going to survive? And yes, people will probably have to leave behind their livelihoods, and what will happen, you will see massive internal migration in the countries, in the climate hotspots around the world. I don't think we should ever go into this that they will all come to Europe or the United States. They won't. They will try to survive in their own countries, but under abominable circumstances. So yes, the climate emergency is one of the big, big challenges of our time, and I hope that politicians refocus on it and spend their political capital and their political energy on trying to resolve it. And we have the solutions to
it. Your response to President Trump, basically his mantra is drill, baby, drill.
Well, renew energy, and let's get into a much better world. I mean, we know that the fossil fuel is not going to be the future. That's the past and even behind the past. So we absolutely need a rethink of all of these things.
Just outside the UN Human Rights Council, right outside the main door in the hallway, the council has agreed to the Sahrawi women building a haima, a tent, that is so familiar to the indigenous people of Western Sahara. They have fought for decades to organize a UN-backed referendum on independence. Volker Turk, I saw you a few years ago. You reiterated the right to self-determination when addressing the Sahrawi issue, calling for placing human rights at the heart of the issue. What's been the Security Council, the UN General Assembly's decisions regarding the issue of Western Sahara?
Basically, we have decisions taken by the Security Council that have not been implemented. That's the fact of the matter. And
occupied by Morocco since 1975.
Exactly. So we have, and that's, again, one of those long, protracted situations where we haven't seen a resolution. On the human rights front, I've asked to send a mission there, but unfortunately, I have not been successful.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk. To see the full interview, including his remarks on Gaza, go to democracynow.org. We were speaking in Geneva, Switzerland. I'm Amy Goodman.
That's the way I've always sung. This is my song.
Are there subliminal duets?
Absolutely not.
The Metal Meltdown, a show that brings you melody-driven heavy metal from around the world. Melting your ears every Monday night from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.